On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk sci-fi adventure with Total Recall and Minority Report.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast, in a place where everyone has an opinion, two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills. And there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another episode of Video Culture. I'm your host, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And this week's episode, as you heard in the intro, we talked two very sci-fi adventure movies. Now, these are not just sci-fi adventure. These are movies that were adapted from Philip K. Dick short stories that were written like in the 70s.
Yeah, so they are heady sci-fi adventure movies.
And heady meaning like the plot is kind of complex, as well as it deals with a lot with the mind.
Yes. High concept. What is reality? What is destiny?
Right.
Are those things real? You know.
Right. Can we choose our own destiny? Is our mind just making up things? Total Recall. This whole question of is it real or is it just a fantasy that Quaid purchased at the recall place, and then Minority Report dealing with, you know, precognitive crimes, yeah, like being prevented, basically.
Yeah. Is it a crime if you don't actually do it?
Right. There's a moral dilemma and moral paradox that kind of presents itself. And then also, Philip K. Dick also, a lot of sci-fi fans will know, but I mean, I guess I didn't really know. He also wrote Blade Runner.
He wrote Blade Runner,
which is also a very
lot of his stuff has been adapted. He's in the Stephen King range as far as writers have had their work adapted into films.
Yeah, because he didn't really write the screenplay.
No,
he didn't really write the book. These are all just based on short stories.
Yes, and honestly, they're only kind of like his stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're his stories are usually a lot more cerebral. They're not nearly as punchy, punchy, kick, kick. You know, shoot, mm-hmm, shoot. You know.
Right.
They're way more mind trippy kind of stories. So when they get adapted, they definitely get Hollywooded up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot more like, you know, car chases.
Yeah.
But these are two incredibly entertaining films, and I'm super excited to talk about them. We finally got to two of the biggest movie stars in the world of all time with this episode.
Right, Total Recall starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Minority Report starring Tom Cruise.
Yes, so you can't really think of two bigger movie stars in the history of modern film than those two. So I'm glad we finally got to them. I can't believe it's taken us, you know, 20-some-odd episodes to get here.
Well, I mean, granted the fact they didn't really do, neither one of them did a lot of really cult classics. I mean, yeah. Total Recall is probably the closest to kind of a cult classic in sort of like modern day, but it's still, you know, not on people's like top 10 or top 20 like best sci-fi films, you know. Which that's usually reserved for like Aliens or Star Wars or something like,
yeah,
that.
It's almost a little too pulpy in places, I think, for some people.
Yeah.
But and also I think that both these guys have always made such big films, and we've made a conscious effort not to go for the really big films too often.
Yeah, I mean, these were two really blockbuster hits. I mean, really.
But I think they qualify for the show, and this will lead us into talking about Total Recall. They were big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They were really big, and they had cultural impact. But they've definitely become less part of the conversation as time goes on. Like, you don't see a lot of references to Total Recall in 2019.
I mean, I guess you kind of do. There was a modern, more modern version in 2012, which stuck more closer to the Philip K. Dick story. But really, we're just talking about the 1990 version starring Arnold.
Yeah, because we're not a big fan of remakes here, unless it's The Thing by John Carpenter. But that's another story, another episode.
Well, it's just another adaptation. I mean, I guess you would say it's another reinterpretation of the original short story, kind of like the same way you had The Fly, and then you had like Cronenberg's The Fly, right?
True. Yeah,
so I mean, I'm for it, but. Both of us agree that this is the better of the two films.
It has to do with the talent behind the camera more than anything. And Total Recall, let's get into Total Recall, had an amazing director behind the camera, a guy named Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah, Paul Verhoeven. You may not recognize that name.
But you'll recognize his films.
Yes, RoboCop, Basic Instinct, Showgirls, and Starship Troopers. I mean, those are some pretty heavy-hitting, like, sci-fi favorites.
Yeah, even the terrible one in there, Showgirls, is still that's a cult classic.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. The first one was rated NC-17.
Yeah, I mean, it's a trash classic.
In Starship Troopers.
All those movies are wildly entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, and you know what's interesting about it? They're also great satire.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them has this real satirical edge to them, which I think in a lot of ways so does Total Recall. Because it kind of is almost a satire of the idea of the hero's journey.
Right.
But let's get into it. Let's kind of go from.
Also, I just want to mention that the producer of Total Recall, Dino
De Laurentiis.
All right. He also was the producer of Serpico, Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness.
Yes.
And I don't think that you can get bigger cult classic than Army of Darkness or Evil Dead 2.
He really liked popular film styles. He was an immigrant. He loved big, broad movies. If you ever get a chance, look up an interview with him where he talks about film. He's got this wonderful kind of voice and his demeanor. Like, he's kind of like a grumpy man, but you can tell he's like a grumpy grandpa talking about films.
Uh-huh.
Like you imagine him like chewing like a stogie while he's talking to you. But he loves like big Hollywood movies with big ideas.
Okay. And go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, he produced like the King Kong remake in 76 with Jeff Bridges.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's him. Really fascinating guy.
And the writers, the adapter, you know, the screenplay writers, were written by Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett, which they also wrote Aliens.
Dan O'Bannon, yeah. That's a name genre film fans should know. Yeah. Dan O'Bannon has written a lot of really cool things.
Yeah, so you have Arnold Schwarzenegger. You have the producer of Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness. You have the director from RoboCop and Starship Troopers. So, I mean...
And the guy who wrote Alien.
Right, and already you're starting with this huge, you know, sort of like expectation, right? So let's get into the movie. I mean, if you haven't seen this movie by now, like, go out and just stop and go watch it. But it's Arnold where he's...
To me, I told you that I think it's him at the height of his powers. He's charismatic. He's funny. He's imposing. He's everything that people think when they think of Arnold. It's really Total Recall. Like, he's got good jokes. He's got cool fight scenes.
Right.
Everything you want to have an Arnold performance is in Total Recall.
Right.
He's a star in this movie. He's so cool and so fun.
Yeah.
And he gets to show range. Like, he gets to be kind of nervous and shaky as Quaid. And we'll get into the spoiler, but he plays another version of himself that's more confident and cocky.
Right.
You can really see his range in the film.
Well, even when he's playing, playing the husband and having to be the construction worker.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see him as somewhat of an everyday kind of guy. I mean, here's a guy who lives in a really, you know, small little apartment, you know, basically. Yeah. And he's just a lowly sort of like construction worker.
Yeah. I'll go ahead and kind of summarize the plot for people
who
maybe haven't seen Total Recall, though that blows my mind that who hasn't seen Total Recall.
Right, yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger plays a guy named Quaid. He's a construction worker, has a normal life. But he keeps having weird dreams about Mars.
Mm-hmm.
He dreams about going there. Years up because, and see woman
the,
there.
The year is like 2082 or something like that.
It's so in the distant future.
Right, and there's people can regularly go to Mars where they've built there's like a big
colony.
Yeah, well, it's a colony, but
it's like a vacation spot.
Hold on. It's like a canyon, and they've built into the canyon. So we would think of Mars as like building something on top of like this big dome or something like that. But they figure the best way to build out would just be to drill into the side, because it would protect them from like the solar radiation and things, right?
And it's like this enclosed resort area. I mean, people live there, but the people who live there are like workers and people who attend these like vacation resorts on this planet. But anyway, so Quaid dreams of Mars, and he dreams of going to Mars, meeting a woman on Mars, dying on Mars. And his wife keeps telling him, well, you know, don't worry about those dreams. We're not going to Mars. I don't like it there. But he keeps having these dreams and he wants to go. Mm-hmm. So he sees an advertisement for something called Total Recall.
Or just Recall. No,
it's called Recall, excuse me,
And it's spelled different. It's like R-E-K-A-L-L.
Yeah. And so basically what it is, it's a very sci-fi concept. They can implant the memories of a vacation in your mind. So it's like you went, but you didn't actually go.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their packages is a Mars package.
Right.
So it's like, that's perfect. I can just pay a little bit of money and satisfy my urge to go to Mars. So he goes there. He agrees to get the spy package, like the secret agent package, and have this fantasy about being a secret agent on Mars. But as they're going to implant him, he freaks out and starts acting like he actually is a secret agent.
Right.
And he starts acting like everything is actually real. Everything he talked about in his fantasy he wanted to have is actually true.
Right. Like, you blew my cover.
Yeah. You're going to get me killed. You're all going to die.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And basically, from there, he actually escapes to Mars to try to figure out what's going on.
Right. Well, in the meantime, in going back to his, apartment or whatever, he finds his, you know, construction worker buddy was like, hey, let's go have a drink. I was like, no. And then he gets pulled aside where they're actually going to kill him. And then he winds up like in a fight scene where he kills all those guys. And then, you know, he finds out that like, you know, he has left himself, you know, like a briefcase just to help him out. So it's almost like where he's undercover, but his undercover self that he doesn't remember has left all these things for him to help him out on his journey.
So basically, his past self leaves clues for him to figure out who he is. And he goes to Mars to try to unravel this mystery, basically. Right. And he kills a lot of people, you know, has a few laughs.
The henchman who is played, I love the henchman guy because is Michael Ironside. Mm-hmm.
Michael Ironside from Starship Troopers.
Yeah.
From Highlander 2.
Top Gun. The next Karate Kid. Major Payne. X-Men, First Class. Scanners.
Oh. Yeah, he's actually the villain in Scanners, which is a great film by The Flies, David Cronenberg. Right.
And also, let's mention the fact that Sharon Stone plays his wife. Now, this is a very early role for Sharon Stone.
She's great in it, though. It's kind of like a femme fatale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is his wife on Earth, but really she's there to keep tabs on him. And when he figures out what's going on, she tries to kill him.
Right.
You know, and it turns out she's actually Ironside's girlfriend, you know.
Right. Yeah.
A fun little pulpy twist.
Right.
So, you know, Quaid goes to Mars, and I got to say, man, the stuff on Mars, it's all sets. Like, there's not a bit of computer graphics. This is way before computer graphics. This was made in the mid-80s. These sets are so cool. Look, everything feels like...
Late 80s.
You know, was it 86?
1990.
Is it 1990?
Yes.
It's been a long day.
So it was like 89, yeah.
But anyway, so he goes to Mars. And one thing that struck me about watching it again after a few years was everything is so wonderfully practical and tactile in this movie.
Well, I mean, even the subway scenes were originally shot in Mexico City, in the actual subways. But Mexico City subways are like orange. They had to like repaint them like silver. But that was like technically like on Earth, like the Earth subways. But everything. I mean, because to me, the subways didn't look that much different, you know, than the actual, yeah. Like when you actually get to Mars. And the only really thing that you even know that you're on Mars is like they have these big, you know, like glass that's protecting, you know, from the outside, where, yeah. like that's by the canyon that you can actually see, you know, to the outside where you can actually see the red planet, you know. Yeah,
it's a little like Cloud City in Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah. So, but basically, you know, to make a long story short, he winds up kind of almost tricking himself, like, or he almost winds up getting tricked that he's still his, having a sort of like dream sequence. Yes. And the doctor shows up to try to get him out of it. And then he winds up like getting involved, you know, with this woman that he's, you know, from the recall place that he's ordered, basically. Yeah. And they, you know, wound up basically being a part of the rebels to try to
free Mars, basically.
Free Mars, because the main head henchman is like holding all the air, and you know, from yeah. you know, from these people, and basically yeah. overcharging them basically to
have
stay
air,
there.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the plots of the movie, and kind of Philip K. Dick stories in general, is like we talked about earlier, is the idea of what is real,
right?
And what is reality? And the movie toys with it in this movie by saying, well, is this actually happening to Quaid, or is this the fantasy they implanted in him? Because when he sets up his fantasy in Recall, all the details he mentions are referenced later in the film.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead. And you got to wonder, is this what they implanted, or did he ask for those things because he subconsciously remembered it?
Right.
And you never really know. Uh-huh. But the film gives hints in either direction.
Right. Well, I mean, he does wind up, like, saving the planet where they, you know, he winds up killing both the head henchman and also, like, the leader where they, you know, he escapes. But he winds up setting off this, like, reactor that's been there for, like, a million years that were built by the aliens.
Martians, I would guess.
Yeah, Martians. Yeah. That basically, like, it kind of terraformed the planet, basically. So this idea of terraforming where you introduce something to give the planet, like, some atmosphere.
It happens with a they say it's based on a giant glacier being in the center of the planet.
Right.
And they introduce heat to it. Right. I don't think that would actually work.
Yeah.
It's very much a movie science, but you just go with it because you're having so much fun watching Arnold, like, beat people up.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a wildly fun movie. It's got great practical effects.
Yeah.
There's so many cool, like, makeup jobs in it. Like, one of the plots of the movie is because of the radiation, and some of the poorer people on Mars have ended up having mutated children. Right. So there's a whole subculture.
Well, there are mutants, and then they have mutated children.
Yeah. Well, and basically, like, there's become great a whole subclass of like, the poor people on Mars are mutants with terrible deformities and slight psychic abilities.
Yeah, and it's just, to me, it was just weird to go to Mars, and it's like there's a bunch of debauchery going on,
yeah.
and it's like, you know, you're wound up in, like, you know, 1974 New York City, you know, that sort of thing. It was kind of like in the red light district, you know, on Mars.
Like that's where all the crazy stuff happened now.
Yeah. I mean, why? I mean, I guess because it's Mars. Because we would think that, like, Mars would have all these, you know, would be very high tech and would be very clean and be scientists. And,
and it's kind of like got this kind of like third world country ghetto aspect.
Yeah, kind of very sleazy things. Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's you have to either the very, very rich or the very, very poor.
Yeah.
And, but the mutants are basically the rebelling against this evil corporation. They're part of the resistance that are basically having a little, like, mini war on Mars over this oxygen situation. And they're being led by a mysterious mutant named Quato.
Yeah.
Quato is probably one of the most memorable things about this movie.
Yes.
Because you don't know who Quato is until near the end, when you discover one of the regular characters in the film, who's just a guy, just an average looking guy, is actually a mutant. But his mutation is he has a conjoined twin in his chest. Mm-hmm. And the twin, not him, but his twin, is Quato, basically a deformed conjoined twin who's got powerful psychic abilities. It's kind of like a little deformed Yoda in a way.
Yeah.
And he has that great line about Quaid. Quaid, release the machine. You know,
no, open your mind.
Open your mind. That's what it is. Yeah. Open your mind, Quaid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of those lines that was quoted a lot in pop culture.
Yeah.
In like the. In
actually
like,
sampled in some other songs.
Yeah. In like the 90s and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's one of his cultural impacts. And it's such a cool. There's so many cool, like, gnarly, like, prosthetic effects in this film. You have people with, like, bug arms and, like, half their faces covered up with, like, skin flaps. Yeah. Or they have, like, bulbous skulls.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's very. It's a very fun. It's very sort of. You know, just an adventure story. I mean, you follow Quaid. You see things through his eyes and how you're figuring things out. Yeah. So you don't really get a sense of, you know, what's going on. So you're discovering things as he's discovering things. And and in that sense, it's very fun to discover, like, this whole second world. And then when you wind up, like, he sets off the reactor, and then there's that weird scene at the end where he's, like, you know, can't breathe because he's been sucked out to the actual planet, and his eyes are bulging, and the other, you know, everybody's like eyes are bulging, and then all of a sudden the atmosphere forms, and then they can breathe.
Yeah, he can breathe again. Yeah. And even that's a really cool practical effect. Like, I mean, the Arnold heads and the prosthetic Arnold heads in this are really impressive.
Yeah.
You know, I love old school makeup effects, and this movie is chocked full of them.
Yeah.
And it's so fun, and the story is mind trippy. But it's also got a good, like, action backbone to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got Arnold fighting for the little guy, so it's real easy to root for him.
Yeah, right.
It's so much fun. And it's got some great jokes in it. Like you know, he's...
The one-liners, like consider it a divorce.
Yeah, like when he kills his wife.
Yeah.
And at one point, the bad guy taunts him, saying he's going to brainwash him again. He's like, I'll see you at the party after your brainwash, basically. And then he kills the guy, and he's like, see you at the party, Richter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's just. Oh, I gotta say,
yeah, Moz.
Yeah, Moz. After watching that, I prefer a day afterwards. I was randomly saying Mars the way Arnold does in that movie, which is Moz.
Yeah, Moz. I know. Me and my wife wound up saying air. You know, like. So even now, when me and my wife. Like need air for something. Yeah. We joke about that, you know, scene where it's like,
clutches your throat. Yeah. It's so fun. And it's everything you want out of like that style of movie. It's just, and it's well directed. There's not one dull moment. Every scene leads into the next. Mm-hmm. That movie just rips along. It really does.
It really does. There never a dull moment whatsoever. I think.
Oh, my favorite goofy pun in the movie is when he's killing the guy with, he's killing one of the bad guys with a giant drill.
Oh,
he literally screams, "Screw you!"
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And that's I'm sorry. That's quality filmmaking. Five million stars.
Oh, I love Benny. I love Benny. Yeah. I got five kids to feed. Yeah. You know, and yeah, that was great.
Yeah, I gave the movie three thumbs up.
Yeah. So let's talk about the ending.
Yeah, let's talk about the ending.
So the ending leaves you questioning whether this was real, or this was a dream implanted by recall. Okay, so there's evidence, I think, really to support it either way.
I agree.
I will go ahead and tell you that the director has said, "Oh, it was a dream," but I don't know, because I think that there's evidence, like I said, pointing in either direction. Some of the direction, though, that people have said. Has he says that in the scene where Dr. Ajmer visits Quaid, he says that if Quaid kills him, the walls of reality will come crashing down. Well, right after that, the bad guys like came in, they crashed through the walls, right? So then he says that Quaid will believe himself. The savior of the resistance, only to discover that he is in fact Cohagen's bosom buddy, which is exactly what happens. And he says that he will have visions of an alien civilization, which Quaid experiences in the mind meld with Quato. But the director, Verhoeven, points out that if a viewer believes the whole field is a dream, then Edgemarch's prediction that Quaid will wind up being lobotomized is fulfilled when the fade to white ends the movie.
And that's certainly his opinion, and the text could point you that way. But there are a lot of things in the film that we see that are not from Quaid's perspective.
Right.
So that kind of goes against it being purely Quaid's delusion. And in that scene with the doctor, when he says, when I've been brought into your fantasy to kind of bring you out of it, you know, you see, he's afraid of being shot by Quaid. Why would he be afraid of being shot by Quaid if he wasn't actually there?
Yeah, right. That's why that's the sweat or whatever yes. from his head or whatever.
And that's a plot point. Was he sweats? And if it's a simulation, he wouldn't be afraid of the gun when he's clearly afraid of the gun.
Right. Yeah, because he's sweating. And then the other thing to me is like everything that was in the pitch, the sales pitch, where he's gonna, he's gonna get the girl, kill the bad guys, and save the entire planet. That all happens. Mm-hmm. So to me, the end, the fade to white could be the end of his dream.
Yeah,
you know,
it could just be him waking up if right. he chooses to look at it that way. I think it's more fun to think of it as real.
I agree. I mean, obviously you think that it's real and not just like a dream.
Yeah.
But I think Peter Van Hoven said it like in his in the DVD commentary. I didn't watch the DVD commentary, but
you should. It's really good.
Yeah. But he said that, you know, that was kind of his original intent, but in talking with Arnold and seeing like Arnold play through, he knew that audiences would like it more if, you know, they thought it was real.
European directors often, and he's Dutch, often tend to have a more of a fatalistic outlook on film.
Okay.
They don't buy into the idea of popcorn entertainment like Americans do.
Right.
So that it's not surprising to me at all that he feels like it was a dream. He would have a darker interpretation of it. Because, right. I mean, that's kind of just their vibe, you know. And, you know, Americans tend to be more like, hey, it's just a good old time.
Right.
And
yeah, that's true.
I think the movie points you in either direction for the reasons we both laid out.
Well, yeah, because if it's just a dream, then like it was just a simulation. You know what I mean? Like it's not real.
Well, and why would he see all those scenes of the bad guys bickering with each other when he wasn't there?
Right.
Yeah, your memories aren't like a TV show. You don't see parts that you're not in. Your memories are all from your point of view.
Right. That's true. That's very
just something to think about. And like I said, I think both ideas are valid.
Right.
I think it's more satisfying.
Right.
To think of it as a true adventure story.
Right. And we don't get to see the other girl that he's dreaming about in his dreams. Like so when like the opening scene when he's with his wife, you know, with his actual wife at the beginning, like we don't get to see, he tells about the dream and she kind of gets jealous about this other girl that he's dreaming about, but he, you know, we don't get to see her basically.
Yeah. So we don't know if it actually is the girl on Mars or not.
Right. Yeah. We have no idea.
It's fun in its ambiguity.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
I think as I'm getting older, I like to err more on the side of it is what it is and it's fun.
Right.
But definitely, the text supports either theory if you choose to look at it that way.
Yeah. I guess I've always thought about it. Even when I saw it, I thought it was, you know, like a dream.
Yeah.
Like, because even if he's in, like, if he goes to recall, like, the story has to kind of have a catalyst to start of how he's going to get to Mars.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you're going to implant a memory, you can't just go, oh, I'm in Mars.
Suddenly I'm on the train.
You've
got
to be able to get to Mars.
Yeah.
And
Mars.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, so I think about it as like if there was this place called Recall and like say, oh, I want to go to Disney World and ride all the rides with like no, you know, no lines and all this stuff. Like, how would you get to Disney World? Like, you have to get there.
Yeah.
So for it to be a reality, it can't just be like, oh, I'm there. Oh, and here's my pictures.
As you would remember leaving and going.
Yeah. Right. You have to feel real. That's the way I always thought about it.
Yeah. And some people, when they argue theories about what movies are about, you go, oh, you're wrong or you missed this.
Right.
I think the movie equally supports all theories.
Yeah.
I really do. I think the movie, and that's part of its brilliance because Dan O'Bannon's a great writer.
Yeah.
it really has all that in it, and none of it contradicts itself. It's really wonderfully constructed.
Yeah. I think that's why that's what makes it so great. I think you can find evidence to support either theory. Yeah.
And it's so cool to have a fun pulpy Arnold movie that you can really pick apart and dissect like that. Because I mean, I love Arnold to death. You can't really dissect on a deeper level a lot of his films.
Yeah, like Commando. Like, yeah. I mean,
well, there's a whole underlying homosexual subtext to Commando that we're not going to get into, which is cool. We're not going to get into that.
Well, I mean,
I don't want to get angry letters from Arnold fans.
Well, any of those like male. I mean, even like Rambo has some of those. That
it's
true,
and that's fine. I mean, It's perfectly valid. But yeah, but this is probably one of the again. It's one of the more thoughtful Arnold action movies. That's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah,
it's thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Very true. Very true. So let's move on to okay. So here is the weird part, and this is the one fact I will mention now before we get to the end, and this will kind of segue the two movies to kind of together, even though. These are both Philip K. Dick stories. Neither one of us knew this fact before we started watching these movies for this podcast, is that immediately due to the success of Total Recall, it debuted at number one in the theater, and they immediately started working on a sequel. Because, I mean, how easy is it to come up with a sequel to this movie? I mean, obviously, you can still have Quaid can still exist. Like, you can say, oh, it was real. Or you can put Quaid somewhere else or whatever.
He's still on Mars.
Yeah. You know. And Arnold sought out Peter Verhoeven to work with. So, you know, there were...
Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah, thank you.
They missed letters is all.
So when they started thinking about what they could do with Quaid, they looked to another Philip K. Dick short story to adapt. And one of those was called the Minority Report. Now... Philip K. Dick's story, they kind of plot twisted it a little bit to make it fit for Total Recall, meaning that where you have these precognitives that can predict crime, and then so the SWAT team can swoop in and stop the crime before it happens. But the clairvoyance in this case, in the Total Recall 2 version.
Yeah,
were the people from Mars, were the mutants from Mars, because they were clairvoyant.
Yeah, they were all psychic. If you were mutated, you had psychic abilities, some less, some more, but they all had it. So that's pretty cool to think it would have been about these mutants.
Right.
Predicting crime, maybe Arnold stopping it.
Right. But you have to remember, Total Recall was made in 1990, and it was like 12 years later that... Minority Report gets made, not starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Was it just 12 years later? Not
2002. Really,
we're getting so old, man.
I know. So Minority Report, not starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, but starring Tom Cruise, and it has nothing to do with, you know, Quaid, has nothing to do with any of that. So obviously there was something changed. I'll reveal more a little bit later in the text about I'll explain exactly how it happened and how it came to Steven Spielberg and how he got involved. Yeah. But we'll save that for the end. But now we have Minority Report starring Tom Cruise.
So stay tuned for that. But now we're going to talk about Minority Report.
Minority Report. So given that, you have another story where I love this total movie where it's set in the future. It's set in like 2050 something. So it's not set so quite in the future. But... given that it's Steven Spielberg, like, he went to great lengths in the technology in this film to make, and the way that it was shot, the way that it looked, the way that the story is told. So from the moment that, you know, a lot like Total Recall, from the moment it starts with that ball, like, coming down, you know, and, like, coming up with the name and everything, you're like hooked in to the story about what the heck is going on.
Yeah,
and you get to see how the precognitives and, you know, this law enforcement team sort of work together where they get a name of a person that dies and a name of the person that's killing, and they get images and they
have to figure it out. So it doesn't make it too easy for the cops.
They get images and they get kind of like a bad 8mm, like, you know, film, but they're having to like back it up and You know, they just get like
together, yeah.
Yeah, they just get like little snippets, little images.
You know, they're trying to like find, you know, is there any mail on the table in the background that we can see an address? Yeah. Can we pick out landmarks from this little bit of a psychic image?
Yeah.
Try to figure out where this crime's going to happen before it happens.
Right.
So they can go and stop it. Mm-hmm. And so these are all done by three psychics who they basically keep sedated in a room, basically.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's two boys, two twins, and a woman.
It kind of reminds me of those like those water isolation chambers,
yeah,
where like the water is like your body temperature, and it's kind of like they put salt in it so you can float on top. That's what I think. Like, yeah.
It has that vibe to it. Like they
immersion chambers when they're
called. Yeah, basically they're heavily sedated and they're just used for this, and it brings up some moral questions almost immediately that they're kept like this. But the movie gets to that later on, but in the beginning, you're just trying to watch them trying to stop a crime before it happens. So it opens with a real tense sequence of them trying to piece together this crime and getting there to prevent a murder. And these cops are led by Tom Cruise, who plays a haunted, kind of grizzled detective who lost his son to basically a violent crime.
Right. And right.
He doesn't know what happened. But part of the reason he's so gung-ho for this thing is because he knows if they had had this when he was younger, his son would have lived.
Right. And these, you know, you kind of get to see this from the Colin Farrell plays this sort of like detective who's investigating this. Because,
auditing kind of.
Yeah, auditing, where they're talking about like this, you know, this sort of thing happens just in the Washington, D.C. area. But they're talking about making it go national because, you know, they've had like, you know, not like zero murders.
Yeah, they've
like
eliminated basically all murder.
Yeah, or all what they call like precognitive murder. Like, yes, if somebody just like, you know, playing a card game and somebody flips out, they can't do that. But the precognitive murder.
Well, I think what they said was they can't do things like rape and robbery, but any kind of murder they can catch. It was other violent crimes like non-lethal crimes.
Right.
This something about the way the psychic energy worked, the mumbo jumbo, so they couldn't detect that. But still, they've eliminated all cases of murder in the D.C. area.
Well, and then they said they also talked about how when they first started, they stopped because all of these people were the premeditative crime that everybody kind of like go, oh, wait. So if I even think about crime, I'm going to get, you know, arrested. So almost nobody
does any sort of
premeditative crime. They pretty much eliminated premeditative crime just by them existing.
Yeah, through fear.
Right. And then so now all they have are like they have to work very quickly because it is like the people like in the card game where like they're about to shoot somebody. And so they get like only like about 30 minutes or so before it happens. Yeah.
And basically the crux of the movie is Colin Farrell's doing this investigation and Tom Cruise is running this task force. Well, one day, you know, the names come up on the board and it's Tom Cruise's character's name is the murderer. And it's a man he's never heard of is the victim.
Right.
And it happens in 3 days.
Right.
But Tom Cruise is like,
Because it's they said it was a premeditative murder and they've said these hardly ever happen.
Yeah. And he's like, I don't know this man. I don't know why I would kill him in 3 days. So basically at that moment, because the system is just like, you don't get to defend yourself. You're just arrested and put away.
Yeah.
So he immediately bolts.
Right.
In fact, the tagline for the movie was, for a while, some of the posters and the trailers were, everybody runs.
Yeah, everybody runs. I mean, the plot is so weird and so, like, sort of convoluted. And I'm trying to think of a better way to sort of break it down into a very sort of simplistic sort of way.
I don't think you really can.
But basically he winds up kidnapping the girl.
Yeah,
he goes away, goes to his like estranged wife's house to try to protect himself. And then basically gets like taken in. Yeah. Colin Farrell sort of figures out that like there's something fishy going on.
There's corruption, yeah.
Yeah, with one of the murders. Because one of the precognitives is trying to pull... you know, we keep talking about Tom Cruise and I'm getting mad because his name is John Anderton.
John Anderton?
Chief John Anderton.
Okay. Well, and so...
that John pulls him aside and says, you know, see, and so you get the idea, because I want to explain what Minority Report means, is that the, like, she's trying to give the this Agatha, the, you know, the one female, is trying to show John Anderton that there's something else going on, that there was some sort of corruption, like something's different. So you he starts to get the idea of, like, what a Minority Report is, and the Minority Report is where they have three cognitives, but, like, if one of them disagrees, then, like, then they're, you know, like, that's expunged or whatever. They have a different sort of version of the events.
And his character and the entire force behind this, except for the head of it, didn't know. They were led to believe that they always that the psychics always agreed, and they discovered this Minority Report proves that a lot of the time they didn't, and that means they've been arresting people with no trial, putting them in prison, on basically tainted evidence.
Right, because they didn't all three of them like agree, and they basically hid this away because they knew that this was just going to introduce some sort of, like, well, you know, they go to trial and they it's going to introduce doubt. So they hid this from view from everyone. And they even, like, wiped the records completely from whatever that the memory was. The only way to get the memory is to actually go to the source, go to the actual, you know, precognitive person to try to, like, pull those memories out. So anyway, it winds up being a corrupt. The whole guy started it all because he wound up killing the mother of Agatha because he knew that Agatha, he needed Agatha, and her, his, you know, Agatha's mom was like, no, I don't want, you know, I don't want her in it. But he knew to start the company that he was going to have to, you know, he wanted to kill her, you know.
He needed her psychic abilities because she had the strongest psychic ability.
Right.
And so it started out with corruption and, and he knew that eventually...
He kind of played the system in reverse, kind of reverse engineered a murderer, sort of, right?
Yeah, basically. And we will go into specifics of how he did it. It's pretty clever and interesting. The whole movie is very interesting. Mm-hmm. But basically, he sets up Tom Cruise when he begins to worry that the whole thing may become unraveled.
Right.
He's worried that people are going to find out. So he basically frames Tom Cruise to try to protect the program so it can go national.
Yeah, like they pick a guy that, like... had pictures of his son, and he basically confessed, you know, to, like, killing his son. So he wound up, you know, like, wanting to kill him, but he actually doesn't. The guy, like, kind of pulls the trigger on himself, right?
Yes. And the entire movie is really Cruise trying to unravel all this and solve the mystery and stay alive.
Right.
And it's really, it's kind of a chase movie.
Right.
He's being chased by sci-fi cops, basically. Like, I mean, his old unit is basically trying to track him down.
It's kind of like The Fugitive.
It's a lot like The Fugitive, yeah.
Yeah, where, like, you have a guy who is a very, like, esteemed guy, but he's the guy that's now on the run.
Yes.
And you know, he finds out information, he, you know, and then he's able to kind of use that to try to, like, gain leverage.
It's,
you know,
very much The Fugitive. That's a good call out. Yeah. It's a really fun movie. Spielberg, of course, is a great director. He knows how to piece together amazing action sequences. Mm, he's got a real sense of, he makes everything kind of, even though it's heavy subjects, he makes it feel kind of light and enjoyable. He sprinkles in comedy here and there that doesn't break you out of the movie.
Yeah.
Full of wonderful performances, lots of great side characters.
Yeah.
It's a really fun movie, and the story's engaging.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it maybe doesn't quite all add up, you know, sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's a little too twisty-turny.
Yeah.
And if you think about it too hard, it kind of falls apart, but it's still enjoyable.
Yeah.
And it's just a great movie.
Well, I mean, he winds up, like, you know, I think it's funny because you wind up with the moral dilemma of the head of the company, you know, like supposed to be killing John Anderton. He pulls a gun out on him, you know, but he says, you know, you haven't chose, like, your future isn't decided yet, you know, you don't have to do this. And then he winds up turning the gun on himself because he knows that he, you know, is in trouble and he's just going to wind up. And, you know, instead of offing him, he just offs himself. But anyway, and then the precogs go, like, you know, they get released because, you know, they're, people don't want to be a part of that whole, you know, questioning system or whatever. Yeah, so.
Because it's flawed. And one of the interesting ideas that the movie brings up that it doesn't really address too much because it's pretty dark is when they basically admit the system has flaws, they have to let everyone go who they've arrested.
Yeah.
And some of those people were bad people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you have this in your notes, but originally in the end of the film, they show the precogs being happy and, you know, away in like a cabin out in nature.
Yeah.
There was a bit of dialogue at the very end of the movie they cut out. That goes through all Tom Cruise's happy ending stuff. And then he goes, and there were 300 murders that year in D.C.
Yeah. Or 130.
Something like that. Yeah. Some high number.
Yeah.
So that, yes, you know, everything's kind of morally right now, but at what cost did they choose the morality of, of, you know, the judicial system? Like, you know, we gave up on this thing that was going to save lives to free innocent people, but that invariably got people killed as well. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting idea, and I kind of wish they had left it in the film.
Yeah, like, you know, it's that there's a paradox. I can't remember what it is, but I was just watching a TV show, The Good Place or whatever.
And an excellent show. Yeah.
They were talking about, like, you know, the one about the streetcar. Like, if you have a streetcar and, like, you pull one lever and it's going to, you know, run into this, but if you pull the other lever, it's going to run into a person, and so you have to make this like moral choice about what the lesser of the evils are, whatever.
Lesser of two evils.
Lesser of two evils, and that's the kind of like what's going on here. So there's this idea first where you have the idea of we haven't chosen our own fate, right? Like, have we, just because we thought about a crime, are we going to really actually go through and commit this crime? Mm-hmm. And then you also have the idea of, like what we just said, where, you know, at what cost are we willing to, you know, end all these murders, basically? Like,
yeah, because they didn't, some of those people, we don't know for sure they were going to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, are we going to lock up innocent people? Are we going to put these precognitives in, like, some sort of, like, sedative coma, you know, comatose state just so we can do all these kind of things? I mean, I immediately, you know, thought about, you know, like the Constitution and all this stuff, like you're innocent until proven guilty. Like that would all have to be, you know, sort of like completely wiped and expunged away, basically. Because it was like, you're innocent until the precogs say that you're going to kill somebody, you know?
And yeah, like, and that's such a scary idea, the fact that you could be judged for something that you haven't done.
Yeah.
Because someone thinks you're going to do it.
Right.
And that goes back to, again, to the idea of reality and free will and destiny, which are things that again, Philip K. Dick was pretty fascinated by. That at least I'm glad Hollywood kept those ideas in his films, not always as heavy as he used them, but they're still there.
Let me also, okay.
Sure.
So let me introduce the idea. Now, this is a fan theory. It once again goes sort of kind of like Total Recall, where you don't know what's real or what's not in the end. And some fan theories have theorized that, you know, when these people, these murderers get put away, they get put in sort of a suspended state. And the guy, what's his name, that plays the guy?
The prisoner?
Gideon. Warden? Yeah, Gideon.
That's played by Tim Blake Nelson.
Tim Blake Nelson, who people know from like, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, The Incredible Hulk. He's in a bunch of stuff. Yeah.
So, yeah, he's the guy that's like, we thought you were a toad. Anyway.
He's great. Yeah. Great character actor.
So, but yeah, he's in that movie playing Gideon, who's kind of like the keeper. And he says, you know, they say all your dreams come true. And, you know, from the start, you know, the start of the movie, you kind of see, like, you're kind of introduced, you kind of get the introduction of how the whole system works. And then when John Anderton's ball is dropped, he's on the run after he gets, you know, and everything sort of like happens in a very sort of negative way. After he gets captured, things start to turn around for him. Like, he starts to get the upper hand in the story.
His wife rescues him, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
And you sort of end on this very sort of positive note where these dreams where he's back with his wife. I mean, he can't really get his son back at this point, but, you know, he's not wrestling with these things. He's not, like, on whatever drugs he was on and, you know, sad and lonely and, you know, the precogs are released. He knows that, you know, all of this stuff is sort of like, you know, cleaned up. And so the idea is, was that part of his suspended state or was it real?
And I think the film, I hadn't even thought about that, but you're right. The text does kind of leave that up for you to decide. And I think that's what would have made it, a very interesting sequel to Total Recall for that very reason, because that has the same kind of thematic idea to it.
Yeah.
You know, is this reality? Is he dreaming?
Right. And not to mention in the fact, in the movie, you also had a very place that was like Recall, where these people were like, you know, had like in the chairs. Remember that scene?
Yeah.
They're in the chairs and it's like they're imagining like these things are happening, but they're really not happening. So it's like it was almost like this is what I imagine. If Recall was actually a place, it would look like that. It wouldn't look like a lab that you would, you know,
it would look like a Dave and Buster's.
It wouldn't look like a doctor's office. Yeah. It would look like a Dave and Buster's. Like,
yeah, that totally would look like, yeah, this like fantasy arcade in Minority Report. It totally had this like cyberpunk Dave and Buster's quality to it. So you're right. And that's another thing. I didn't even think about that, but you're right. That was another thing. It had people actually going through those Recall like reality fantasies in Minority Report. Yeah.
Yeah. Where you see like one guy with like, you know, three girls, you know, like around himself. Yeah. It's like,
or like accepting an award, or one guy was killing his boss, you know, that kind of thing.
So maybe that's the kind of thing that people have to do because there are, you know, precognitives, you know what I mean? They have to, you know, do these kind of things. It was kind of seedy. It wasn't quite as seedy as like, you know, and pulpy as like, you know, what was in Total Recall. No, but
it was glossier for sure. But the ideas are definitely in the same ballpark.
Right.
You know, the idea of, you know, free will and sometimes your only escape from this is in your own head.
Right.
You know?
So I just thought that was interesting. I mean, not only the technology and the cars. I hadn't thought about that,
but you're right. Yeah. You're right. It is very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not only that, but the cars and the reading of the retinas and, you know, these like ads talking to you, saying your name and like.
It's so close to where we are now, just in a more exaggerated way. Like, that's one detail I loved about Minority Report is that as he's walking through like stores, they're like, "Hi, John Anderton, have you tried Zest today?"
No, it was like, what was his name? Like Yakamoto or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, he eventually gets it. Yeah. Well, one of the sequences in the movie, he basically, to avoid detection, he gets his eyes swapped out by a street doctor.
Yeah.
Which is a very cyberpunk kind of thing.
Yeah, very cyberpunk.
Because that's how they read your identification is with your eye, is with your eyeball. So he gets swapped out, and after that, they start calling him Yakamoto every time he's tagged by one of these things. But ads will basically scan your retina and immediately start talking to you. It'd be like, "Hi, Ryan, have you tried Papa John's this evening? Are you hungry?"
Right, but that's how he even got into the subway, is that, like, you didn't pay to get in the subway. He just scanned his retinas, and, you know, like, that's it just charges your account.
Credits deducted.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's how you do everything.
I wonder how many people in accidentally bought pay-per-view with that.
I mean, how would you? Yeah. I mean, how can you control that? Like, what to buy?
I don't want to watch, you know, Happy Gilmore 3. Dang it.
Well, I mean, even in Total Recall, he had to use his thumbprint to get, like, the box or whatever. Yeah.
Which is so weird because we have that. And we have thumbprint readers now, and it's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, you do it to unlock your phone, you know? And it's like, he was doing it to, like, for his identification so he can get into his, you know, his lockbox or whatever.
Yeah, I've always told people now, I firmly believe that we live in low-key cyberpunk times. We just don't all wear leather outfits and sunglasses.
All right, well, let's get to the facts. I got a lot of facts to get through.
Hit me, man.
I'm going to go as quickly as I can. We talked about, you're not going to believe this, but the producer of Total Recall had Richard Dreyfuss and then later Patrick Swayze as Quaid.
I can see Swayze.
Okay, I can see Swayze too.
Because he's a real kind of leading man, good actor. He can do action. I'd even say that'd probably be a pretty good movie. Yeah. But Richard Dreyfuss, I guess that's kind of goes back to wanting Quaid to be an everyman and have it be surprising when he starts.
Yeah, well, I mean, the original Philip K. Dick story, the Quaid was original, like an accountant. That's another one of my facts. And then when Schwarzenegger got involved, then it kind of changed.
Yeah.
So David Cronenberg was also involved in the rewrites of the film. Total Recall went through a total of 44 rewrites before it actually became what we now know as the movie.
Wow.
Yeah. So when David Cronenberg took over, he felt it was too close to the original story. So he said, no, 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 no. He said, we want Raiders of the Lost Ark go to Mars. Which is so true, if you think about it.
It is.
It's a very much an adventure story. It's very much, you know, even the scene, like, even the scene where they have, where he turns on the thing, it's like this pedestal and this little, like, orb-looking thing.
Very much like the idol scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark that opens the film,
Yeah, exactly. But this, like, closes the film. So it's kind of like, anyway.
There's echoes there for sure.
Yeah, and I think just the adventure part of the whole idea, you know what I mean? So, and the henchmen and all that kind of stuff. Eventually, De Laurentiis lost interest, and Schwarzenegger learned about the film, convinced Caracollo, which is Caracollo Film Company, to buy the rights to the film, and Schwarzenegger obtained veto power over the producer, the director, the screenplay, the co-stars, and the promotion.
People forget what a huge movie star he was at the time.
So he wasn't just acting in it, like, hey, we got the script, why don't you come be in it? No, he wanted to basically do everything the producer does.
Yes.
I don't think he got a producer credit either. Yeah. But yes, he had veto power, which means they got to do their stuff, but if they made a decision he didn't like, they said no.
Well, that's the thing about Arnold. He always seemed, in his best, he always felt like he really understands what he's good at and what makes him look the best.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons why it was sort of rewritten to fit his, like, sort of style. He was actually courted to play RoboCop by Peter Verhoeven, but he had
Paul Verhoeven.
Paul Verhoeven. Yeah. All right, Verhoeven.
Okay.
I'm sorry, man.
I'm trying to avoid his getting angry letters.
I'm sorry, Paul. I'm sorry, fans. He's Dutch. It's a odd last name for me, but he wanted, Paul Verhoeven wanted Schwarzenegger for RoboCop, but Schwarzenegger had issues with the RoboCop suit.
It did not look comfortable for sure.
No. I mean, and how huge he is and like, yeah it would be weird.
Like Peter Weller, who actually played RoboCop, small man.
Yeah. In earlier scripts, Wade was an average looking accountant type. But it was Schwarzenegger, because he's bigger, he suggested that they change him to a construction worker. So, earlier scripts as well, it's the original 1974 story. Quaid is listed as Quail, Q-U-A-I-L, but also the adapted, so there's the screenplay, and then there's the there's the book Total Recall by Piers Anthony, but that is basically the adapted screenplay. And that also lists the character as Quail, Q-U-A-I-L, but for the movie was changed to Quaid because of George Bush's vice president, Dan Quail, Q-U-A-Y-L-E.
There's a name I'm sure our realtors haven't thought of ever.
Dan Quail. Anyway. It originally had an X rating, but violent shots were cut for different camera angles for an R rating.
It's still really bloody.
Yeah, it's very gory. Yeah. I think they said the death count was like 77.
But every time anyone's like shot or hit, they're like, there's like blood and gore. I mean, it's not like amazingly gory, but it's gory for what it is.
And I think there was one scene where Quaid used you know, a human body shield. And
yeah.
There was the scene where...
I don't mean to laugh, but that scene's so excessive. Like, he's getting shot, and he literally just grabs a random stranger and pulls the random figure in front of him. This random figure gets shot, like, 20 times. And then Quaid throws the dead body of this random poor guy at the bad guys. And that's a Verhoeven kind of thing. Verhoeven, just, he doesn't...
No,
he's got a very kind of nihilistic quality about his violence.
Talking about a guy that goes for the jugular. Yeah. That's the guy. I mean, the scene in RoboCop where, you know, in the conference room scene gets me every time.
The executive gets blown away. Same kind of vibe, though. Yeah, just nihilistically violent.
Just like things normal. Oh, everybody's getting shot. Yeah. Like, okay. And then there was even the scene with Benny. Like, apparently, like, his blood and guts were, like, spilling out and everything. They cut that up. Because basically the way these things are scored too, you have to remember that it's like oh, there's a violent thing. They catch a check mark. And if you get so many of those things, like bad language, okay, there was the F-bomb. We check that mark. And if you get so many, if your score is so high, then, you know, you're only allowed, like, so many.
Yeah.
So they're like, okay, what can we cut at, like, to lower our score?
Yeah, it's a weird system. It really is.
Okay, so to coincide with the movie's release, Sharon Stone posed nude for Playboy magazine, showing off the buff body she developed in preparation for the movie.
So if any of you weirdos and perverts out there want to check that out, you know.
Be a weirdo or weirdo to like look at Playboy magazine.
I'm being silly, man. I'm being silly. But it's out there for you guys to Google. So you guys and girls, if you're into that kind of thing, have at it.
Just letting you know that it exists and it's out there.
We're just watching out for you here at Bioculture.
I'm just doing out facts, okay? All right. This was the last major. You mentioned all of the actual practical effects. This was the actual last major Hollywood blockbuster to make large-scale use of miniature effects as opposed to CGI. So one of those is the X-ray scanner. So that was like a miniature...
Was it?
Like thing or whatever. Yeah, but then when he jumps through it, that's like real, but it's like, you know,
the camera cut, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, but like, yeah, where you actually see the bones and stuff like that. Yeah, and it's like a real quick camera cut because it basically when he kicks it in or shoots it or whatever, like it turns off. So it's just like black. But yeah, that's what they did, you know.
And for an effect that's that old, that effect still looks amazing.
Yeah.
They walk through the X-ray machine and then he jumps through it.
Yeah.
Oh, it looks so cool.
Yeah, it is so cool. And that's a very practical effect. So there's like no CGI. So zero CGI in this film. It's all practical effects. I mean, that just shows you what kind of stuff that you can do with practical effects. And that I would think also like the reactor and stuff like that was probably all like miniature stuff.
It had to be,
Yeah, because they couldn't build something that big. The score is done by Jerry Goldsmith.
Good score.
Which nerds will also know and would probably tell me, and I will get emails and Twitters that, hey, he did the music for Star Trek. He did. And also Planet of the Apes and Patton and Chinatown and Poltergeist and The Secret of NIMH and Gremlins and Hoosiers and Basic Instinct and Rudy and Air Force One and L.A. Confidential and Explorers and The Mummy and three Rambo films and a bunch of other films I didn't mention.
All great scores.
Goldsmith does consider Total Recall as some of his best work.
It's got a great, great score. It's really nice.
After the success of Total Recall, Arnold and Paul Verhoeven. I'm going to get it right.
Maybe it's Verhoeven. I don't mean to throw you
Verhoeven.
Off.
Verhoeven. It's like Verhoeven. So it's like Verhoeven is what it looks like. If you want to pronounce it like very straight Middle Eastern or Middle American, you know, not Middle Eastern. Okay. Anyway, after the success, they also like not only did they try to develop Total Recall 2, but they also, he and Arnold, try to develop a movie about Middle Eastern crusades.
Yeah. The Crusades.
Yeah.
As a guy who's loved film for years and years, I used to read about Paul Verhoeven's Crusades for years, hoping it would get made with Arnold.
I mean, they did all kind of production for this movie, apparently.
Like, it got really close to getting made.
Really close. But the... The studio greenlighted Cutthroat Island instead, starring Gina Davis and Matthew Modine, and that basically bankrupted the studio, and then it never got made.
It's considered a pretty infamous bad studio decision.
Yes. Total Recall debuted at number one in the box office. I already mentioned that. The budget was $50 to $65 million.
Which, at the time, was huge.
It was actually the second most expensive film in history next to Rambo 3. So that just shows you in 1990 what some of the highest budget film, you know, sort of looked like. Was about 50 to 65 million. They had to build 45 sets that tied up 8 sound stages for 6 months. And they did all of this in like Mexico, you know.
I imagine because it was cheaper.
Yeah. Right. And even more so, if they filmed did somewhere in studio, else, yeah, if they did it in Hollywood, it probably cost twice that. It grossed $261.3 million, though. So that's a big return.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
I mean, it made... I can't do math.
Yeah, but let's put it that way.
$65 million, that was a huge hit. Yeah, I mean, gosh.
Yeah.
And to debut at number one, I mean, it wasn't like a slow build. I mean, it was just like, bam, it was there. So how well was it received by critics? Roger Ebert gave it 3.5 stars out of 4. 3.5 out of 4. Yeah. Not absolutely perfect.
He does love his lurid kind of, you know, he likes a little bit of sleaze.
Yeah, but he also likes things to be a little accessible. Maybe he thought that audiences might be turned off a little bit by the violence and things.
Yeah.
But he does say one of the most complex and visually interesting science fiction movies in a long time. I mean, I have to agree.
He's right.
Yeah. Rotten Tomato critic score is 82%, and the audience score is 78%.
I find the audience score a little bit surprising.
Dude, don't worry about a couple of few percentage points in these things. You have to realize that the critics are a much smaller, you know, number that they're That's pulling true. From versus the audience score. Okay.
I don't know. To me, it's just I love this movie. I think it's darn near perfect. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am kind of surprised at the 78% myself. But you know, it is what it is. The Academy Awards, it was nominated for a few things for the Academy Awards. For Best Sound Effects Editing. And I will say, I listened to this one on my headphones. And for a movie that was done in 1990, and really, if you think about it, today, doing sound for a movie in 1990 was that much different than doing it in 1970 versus doing it in 2019. It's a lot of the same techniques. There's not much more that can be done with creating new sounds that aren't there. Okay?
True.
Yeah. So that art, you know, still exists. There's a little more tools that they have digitally, but relatively about the same. The sound is really good. It will really draw you in. A lot of cool stuff. Because there's a lot of like new things, especially that you don't know or we don't have sounds for.
Yeah,
you know?
They're creating, you know, the idea of what certain things sound like. They don't exist in our world.
Yeah. But it won. So those were nominations, but it did win for Best Visual Effects.
Again, this movie has a lot of really cool visual effects.
I mean, that is deserved, given especially the fact that this was, you know, these are practical effects. You know, these were conventional.
Like, you can watch it as a moviegoer now, knowing how movies work, and be shocked that some of it's not CGI. Like, when he pulls off the woman's mask they use in the trailer for that, and then the mask where he's hiding, it looks, you think, well, that's got to be some sort of CGI when the mask opens up. Nope. All practical. They made that.
Well, it was a real, like, woman actor, and then at some point, like, it had to change, and, like, you can see Schwarzenegger like kind of having the woman's like sort of suit on when he pulls the thing out. Yeah.
But it's so subtle that unless you're really looking for it, you're not going to notice it.
No.
You know?
Not a lot. I mean, and it took a lot of like puppeteers, you know, for Quato, you know, to operate. You know what I mean? So that was a really awesome like visual effect.
And
as
the fact
that
it all is practical, you feel like you can touch it because you can. And it gives it a sense of weight and reality that movies nowadays are really lacking in a lot of places.
Right. Let's move on to Minority Report. We know that now that Minority Report was essentially, you know, Total Recall 2, right? So let's talk a little bit about how that came to be. But essentially, what sort of happened is that... you know, it was with this other company that folded because of, you know, the Cutthroat Island. And then was Conco, just kind of, Conco. And it was just because out there. Some people, and it was kind of like Total Recall, too, where some people worked on it, and nobody really wanted to do anything with it. Eventually, Spielberg kind of got interested in it, and that's when he picked it up. And then he and Cruise like kind of got together to make the film. And so, but it was produced by 20th Century Fox, DreamWorks, Amblin Entertainment, and Blue Tulip Productions.
That's almost a Master and Commander level of like studio working together to make
something
happen.
I don't think Blue Tulip was started by a company that started by Jan DeBont, who is a cinematographer for movies such as Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October, and Basic Instinct.
He also
and
directed Speed.
Speed and Twister, yeah. But he never became involved with Minority Report. So it was kind of like he was only by like name only. Like, I don't know why that they're credited with the production. But anyway, and I wonder if, hold on. I don't know exactly how the script came to be, other than Spielberg eventually, you know, got DreamWorks sort of involved, like DreamWorks Pictures at least involved, and got Amblin Entertainment involved. But Cruise and Spielberg each agreed to take 15% of the gross instead of any money up front to keep the film's budget under $100 million.
Surprising, because that movie looks big.
Well, here it is 12 years later, and you're making, you know, this big sci-fi movie, yeah, and it's like costing twice as much to make your movie, right? Yeah, that just shows you where the technology and things have gone. It was almost shot a year or two earlier, but Spielberg shelved it to work more on the script, and then did AI, artificial intelligence, instead. So, but the interesting thing about that, okay, the only reason I mention it is that that version, all right, before AI, had Kate Blanchett as Agatha, Matt Damon as Witwer, which was played by Colin Farrell in the movie, Ian McKellen as Burgess, who played the head of the company, and Jenna Elfman as Laura Anderton.
That probably that's a much stronger cast, I hate
to say.
I
mean, amazing cast.
Yeah.
I mean, holy
cow. I mean, the cast in it now is fine.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's a really strong cast.
Yeah. I mean, God, Kate Blanchett, Matt Damon.
Yeah. Jinx.
Yeah, I know. Jenna Elfman.
Who I've always liked. I've always liked Jenna Elfman.
So anyway, and then later on, they were all off the project like a couple years later. And then Javier Bardem was offered the part of Witwer. But he turned it down because he said, he quote, didn't want to just run around chasing Tom Cruise.
That's fair. Now, for those who don't know, Javier Bardem is the guy who played the killer in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
He was the villain of Skyfall, the James Bond film.
Mm-hmm.
Great actor.
Yeah. I like, man, No Country for Old Men.
Anton Sugar, that's the character's name. I blanked on it. Yeah, he played Anton Sugar in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah, he won an Oscar for that, I think.
I think he might have, yeah.
Yeah. So, also in the movie, Cameron Diaz, Cameron Crowe, and Paul Thomas Anderson make uncredited cameo appearances as bus passengers.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Crowe appears as a commuter on the train who looks at Anderton over the top of his newspaper and recognizes him. So
that's Cameron Crowe.
That's Cameron Crowe, yeah.
And for those of you who don't know, Cameron Crowe is the writer-director of a great movie called Almost Famous.
Right.
Yeah.
He also, he's done a lot of movies. He did Jerry Maguire. Yeah. He did Vanilla Sky. Mm-hmm.
He wrote Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Elizabethtown, Singles.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe is somebody in Hollywood for sure.
Yeah, but I guess that he was like, you know, because he was buddies with Cruise at the time, because they did Jerry Maguire, and they just finished up working on Vanilla Sky.
Which Cameron Diaz was in, so that's probably why they were all around. Yeah, yeah.
Right. I don't know where Paul Thomas Anderson, but anyway.
Yeah.
But Cameron Diaz, she's the blonde woman sitting behind Cameron Crowe.
I'm going to go pull it back out again and watch that scene, because I didn't notice about it. I mean, I remember the character of Cameron Crowe. but no one else. So I'm going to go back and check that out.
And tell audiences where they might know Paul Thomas Anderson from.
He's probably the greatest. He's one of the greatest working directors right now. He directed There Will Be Blood, Boogie Nights, The Master, Inherent Vice, Punch Drunk Love, Magnolia. Paul Thomas Anderson is a master director.
He is credited as Man on Train, but he himself says he does not know where he appears in the movie.
Yeah. He's a surprisingly funny guy, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, here it is in my notes. I remember I was talking about Jan de Bont earlier. I forgot. Sorry. Jan de Bont was credited as producer because he was originally going to direct the film, but Spielberg claimed that de Bont did not work on the film once Spielberg joined.
I imagine de Bont knew his place. He's like, well, Spielberg's going to do this. I'm going to back away respectfully.
Like, yeah, okay, I'll just be over here in the corner. Well, and a lot of times these movies, the way they get written is that they put who the producers are kind of beforehand, and even if they back out, like, they still get, like, the producer credit or something. Yeah. So that's kind of what happened.
Because they had a hand in at least the very early development. Yeah.
Right. The only thing that kept the original Total Recall 2, so the only thing that they kept in that script was the car production scene.
Oh, yeah. There's this neat scene where, and it feels like something you would see in Total Recall,
yeah,
where Anderton is running from the cops, and they're in a car plant, and he basically gets swept up by the car production assembly line, and the car is built around him,
yep,
and he ends up escaping by driving the car away at the end of the sequence.
Yeah, I know. That was so weird.
It's very much like a kind of sequence you would see in Total Recall. Yeah, it feels very similar.
Yeah, and because it was a nice little spoof there, how he winds up like stealing a car, like a Lexus, you know. Yeah.
The car he uses to drive away is literally built around him by robots,
and it's built so quickly. So I think it like shows off the technology, and then also kind of a little bit of absurdity, you know.
It's one of the better scenes in the entire movie, if you ask me.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, Steven Spielberg loved it, so he kept, that was the only thing that was really kept. Everything around it, like, was all changed. But here's the kind of kicker behind that whole thing. The writers, right, the original writers, they actually sued for co-writing credit because of that scene. Okay, so, but the writer, because it was rewritten by this other guy named John Cohen, but the Writers Guild ruled that the original writers can only get, due to like how much time or how much is in
it's
the
a percentage thing.
Yeah, how much did you, how percentage of what you wrote. So they can only get executive producer credit.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, the WGA rules are something we can have a long conversation about. I have friends in the Writers Guild. And they're talking about the MPAA being a weird system. The Writers Guild and credit for writing, that's a very weird, archaic system.
Right. Now, we talked a lot about Total Recall being, conventional effects, right? Like physical effects, no CGI. Minority Report was the first film to have an entirely digitally production design. Now, it was still shot on high speed, what they call Super 35, and it was what's called bleach bypass, which you film nerds know what that is, but it makes the film look sort of washed out and like kind of lose color.
Yeah. It helps blend the effects for sure.
Yeah, but it was edited all digitally, and all the effects are all like digital and stuff like that.
And it looks a little digital in retrospect, now that we've had some distance from it. It looks of its time for sure.
Yes. Because it was very like early. But yeah, to go, that's another reason why, when I was going through the notes, I'm like, neither one of us knew this. I'm like, this is another great reason, serendipitous that these two movies were chosen, I didn't even know.
And just to give credit where credit is due, these facts are coming from IMDb and Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Cool.
So...
Thank you for all you contributors out there. We appreciate it.
And there's more you can read about the bleach bypass process if you want to learn about it. Minority Report was, already read that part. Steven Spielberg, in 1999, Steven Spielberg invited 15 experts to a hotel in Santa Monica for a three-day think tank to come up with some plausible future reality for the year 2054. So, in fact, so much that there is an entire Wikipedia page dedicated to the technologies in Minority Report.
If you guys want to do a deep dive on that, that sounds like it'd be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
We don't have that kind of time on the show today, but...
There was so much in the regular Minority Report page and also the Total Recall page. I just didn't even have time to go back and look at it. So I'm going to go back and look at it again later when I have more time. But I was a little short on prep. But yeah, I mean, it has in it. This is the first time I've ever seen a movie page have a separate, you know, sort of sub page.
Yeah.
You know.
It's rare. It really is. Yeah.
Well, at least the movies that we do, right?
That's true, yeah.
In the Academy Awards, it was nominated for Best Sound Editing.
It had good sound editing. Yeah.
That was it. That was the only nomination. Who won for Best Sound Editing that year? Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
Lord of the Rings. A juggernaut during that time period.
All right. In 2008, Minority Report was nominated for the Top 10 Science Fiction Film list. For the AFI, American Film Institute.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it was nominated in 2008, but I mean, it never made the list. I mean, the top 10 is so hard to break.
Well, and I'm just going to say, you know, it's really good. It's not Spielberg's best. It's like mid-range Spielberg.
I mean, just to show you what kind of movies are on the list, though, like number 10 on that list is like Back to the Future.
Yeah. Yeah, that's stiff competition.
Right, that's number 10.
Yeah.
You got to climb, you know, 9 more movies to get, you know, even somewhere.
Yeah. There. I mean, if Back to the Future is low on that list, yeah.
Yeah. The budget, as I said, was like $102 million. So they went over just a little bit, right? Like $102. Yeah. The box office was $358.4 million.
It was still impressive.
Yeah, almost tripled.
Yeah.
I mean, but they were almost doubled, I should say. Almost doubled what they put in. Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars.
It's a very entertaining film.
And he says, he calls Steven Spielberg a master filmmaker at the top of his form and says, Minority Report is a triumph, a film that works in our minds and our emotions. It's a thriller and a human story, a movie of ideas that's also a whodunit. So he really liked the interplay. And I think Steven Spielberg, too, liked the interplay of how it's like sort of multi-genre. Yes. Like it's a sci-fi, it's a whodunit, it's
chase film. You know,
chase. It deals with these sort of moral dilemmas.
Yeah. And it's anti-concept sci-fi on top of all that.
Yeah, and also you have this like great sci-fi technology on top of all this other.
I mean, it's a really good film. It's just that Spielberg has made so many good films that it falls kind of middle of his filmography to me.
Yeah.
Because he's just made so many great ones.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's true. Like, if it was, like, one director, it would be, like, his best film. But for Spielberg, you know, he's built that, like, level so high, it's hard to get up there.
So consistently for so long. But, yeah, Ebert's not wrong. He's right. I mean... It's a great film.
It still deserves 4 stars to me.
It does. It's
quality. I mean, I think both movies really deserve Ebert's 4 stars.
Me too.
Rotten Tomatoes, the critics, it is higher too than Total Recall's 91%, and the audience is 80%. So Total Recall audience percent was 78. Minority Report is 80.
Well, it's definitely less. I think sometimes it's less sleazy. Total Recall's got a little bit of sleaze to it that sometimes can turn people off.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
I love it. Don't get me wrong. I think Total Recall is superior, but I love them both dearly.
But it's also that time period too. You know what I mean? It's that kind of pulpy bad guy film. I mean, think about all the shoot ups that were done in Commando, or shoot ups that were done in the some of the other movies, or Terminator, or whatever. You know,
like, I think of Total Recall as like it's a good pulpy novel. With like the pages are a little yellow and it's got really cool like painted artwork on the cover.
Yeah.
And like Minority Report is like an ebook on your iPad.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. Yeah.
They're both good.
Oh, true, right.
They're both good. They both have their good their good qualities, but they're very different experiences.
Yeah, kinda like the effects too, where the effects are like real conventional effects versus like the digital effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
that leads me into a thing we always talk about here on this show. If you were to rent these movies from the video store, Ryan, as we do here in the virtual video store that is Video Culture,
right?
Would you keep them an extra day, or would you return them early?
I'd keep them an extra day.
I would buy them from the store.
You'd buy them from the store.
I own these films. I love them.
I will admit, I was so smitten with Total Recall when I watched the movie when I was younger that I was thrilled to find out my high school library actually had the Piers Anthony, like, because I was a Piers Anthony fan as well, and I actually read the Total Recall like book. Although I will say the Piers Anthony book doesn't veer too far away from the
probably not.
The novel, yeah.
But you know, Piers Anthony, for those who don't know, was a noted fantasy author. He wrote many great fantasy novels. The Xanth novels.
Yeah, the Xanth series. And the I was a fan of the Incarnations of Immortality, but that's for another time. That's just another different conversation.
Just a little detail for
it's
the
another
listeners.
Different conversation.
Yeah. But yeah, I love both these films. I think they're films that I own them. I literally own them. I think they're great.
Right.
And I think any sci-fi fan will like these films.
All right, so we have to get to the point where the film recommendations. So I just rented these movies. I come back to the store. This was a great movie. What other movies you got for me, man?
I mean, the obvious one. The obvious ones are Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049.
Right. Obviously.
Blade Runner is the original Blade Runner is based on Philip K. Dick's "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?"
Uh huh.
And it's about what makes us human. What makes us who we are? What is the soul?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a concept he loves to play with. And 2049, which is the more recent sequel starring Ryan Gosling, plays on ideas of what makes us human? What makes us who we are? Our memories, reality. To me, it almost ties in better with Total Recall and Minority Report than the original one does.
Right.
But I think those two movies, and I know they're super obvious choices based on, you know, on who crafted the stories, but they work so well all together.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049. I think The Fugitive, it was a great call out by you. Yeah. I think would be a great one to watch with Minority Report.
Yeah. I don't really. I struggled for Philip K. Dick. I mean, it was just sort of like. So, you know, strange to me, the only thing that I kept thinking about was like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
That's an excellent one because it's, again, it goes back to what is memory? What is love?
Yeah, where you have a failed relationship. And so instead of feeling sad and feeling like, you know, you were involved in this relationship for many years, but like now that you're broken up, everything about where you are, all these memories you still have of this person, and it's like a negative, so it keeps bringing you back to this negative place, so you hire this team to come in and erase the memories, these bad memories.
And basically, these characters, one of them played by Jim Carrey, yeah. I believe the other one was Kate Winslet.
Kate Winslet, yeah.
They keep finding each other,
yeah.
Even though they keep having their memories wiped.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful movie, wonderful bit of low-key sci-fi. It's got Elijah Wood in it in a supporting role,
yeah.
Directed by music video director Michael Gondry,
yeah.
Who worked with the Beastie Boys.
Mm.
Wonderful choice.
Yeah. I mean,
I wish I had thought of that. That's a great choice.
Yeah, no, I just kept thinking about, you know, the mind and, you know, especially like a Total Recall where you have memory implantations and like Eternal Sunshine is about the mind is like an opposite of that. Like you're still playing with what you know, but like you're taking away reality instead of like implanting reality. You know?
And it goes back to the idea of what is fate? What is free will?
Right.
I mean, you can fight these things, but sometimes you can't.
Hey, I made a mistake.
What's that?
I forgot two facts.
What's that?
You ready for them?
Sure.
Here's another thing.
Bonus facts, ladies and gentlemen.
Bonus facts. Here's another thing that ties the two movies of Minority Report and Total Recall together. Colin Farrell was in Minority Report.
That's true.
Right, which was technically originally a sequel of Total Recall, but then Colin Farrell played Quaid in Total Recall in the 2012 version.
Yes, the remake done by Lynn Wiseman. So that's a wild bit of trivia right there, yeah.
And then here's another odd bit of trivia. There was a TV series that Fox produced.
The Minority Report TV series. I forgot all about the Minority Report TV series.
It only lasted like one season. It was like 15 episodes.
Yeah.
There were the guy that played the caretaker, Wally, he was like the only character that like remained.
He returned for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the commercials. I completely forgot there was a Fox TV show based on Minority Report.
I didn't look it up whether you can stream it or not, but...
It's probably out there somewhere.
I don't know, but Yeah, there was, and it was kind of based on the Minority Report, where you have precogs and, you know, solving crime and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, yeah, these movies have influenced so much. I mean, the stories of Philip K. Dick have influenced so much, yeah. And these are two such great, enjoyable sci-fi romps that give us fun things to chew on. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed these this week, man.
Yeah, I really did too. And maybe next week we'll do, or next episode, I should say.
Because we're bi-weekly.
Bi-weekly.
Can't do this all the time. No. I gotta sleep sometime.
I got things to do, man. Yeah. Is maybe we should look at a couple of Arnold movies.
Because, again, watch this remind me how much I love Arnold. And we've neglected the Austrian Oak for way too long. But let's go. I'm going to tease a little bit and say, let's go a little bit lighter for that one.
Okay.
That's all I'm going to say about it.
All right. Well, thanks very much for listening to this episode. We hope you enjoyed it and enjoyed Total Recall and Minority Report as much as we did. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Estrey. Go watch some movies, guys, and get your ass to Mars.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us, and let's all watch movies together.
They've got your bug.
I get a lock.
There! And the bug's in your skull.
Take this thing out of the case and stick it up your nose. Don't worry, it's self-guiding.
Got him.
I lost him.
Welcome to Mars.
You got a lot of nerve showing your face around here.
Look who's talking.
They erased your identity and implanted a new one.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
He's got a hologram!
Welcome to Johnny Cab.
Drive!
Where can I take you tonight? Please fasten your seatbelt.
I want Quaid delivered alive for reimplantation.
That's for making me come to Mars. You wouldn't hurt me. After all, we're married.
Consider that a divorce.
We hope you enjoyed the ride.